Hi FM, 101.9 megahertz of life.
You're listening to 101.9 Hi FM. I'm Benji Shulman, and I've got a bit of a cold, as you can hear. I do apologize, so we might have a show where I might cough once or twice during the show. So I do apologize for that. But other than that, I'm not going to apologize for the show, because it's going to be a great one, as we always have. We're going to be covering a range of different topics, from the cultural to the political to the geostrategic. And it should be a great one. So what is actually going to be happening for your next hour? Let's talk about it. We're going to be talking about some cultural wins and losses for Israel around the world. What is going on in the cultural sphere? We're going to be speaking about the renegotiation of Israeli arms supplied by the Americans. We're going to be talking, and we're going to be talking about some big elections that are coming up. There's three big ones in 6 months' time, and a small one coming up in the next week, and how that is, what to look for, and what is going to be happening with regards to that. So that is on the show for today. I'm looking forward to it. Also looking forward to you being part of the show. 061-895-1019. That is the number to call, or WhatsApp rather, and we can very happily have your perspective on what is going on, because we would definitely appreciate it. So that is what is on the show, and it is, I think, going to be a very interesting one. So looking forward to being part of it, and looking forward to you giving us your comments and your viewpoints about what is going on. So do be part of the show, and assist us to make this the best possible Jewish culture and current affairs show that there is out there, because it is very outstanding and can only be that way, really, with your input. So that is what is going on. And by the way, if you are looking for some wellness, as you can hear, I might need some. Well, Diskin Wellness Clinics for Adults offers convenient and professional healthcare to help you manage health risks. Whether you're having your regular checks, such as blood pressure or cholesterol, Diskin Wellness Clinics offers you a broad range of health screening services, including female health screening with pap smears, family planning, and pregnancy screening. Fast, affordable, and with care, find your nearest Diskin Wellness Clinic inside Diskin Pharmacies. Better health starts here. I'm Benji Shulman. This is Studio 972, and we are going to be just after this break talking about the cultural wins and losses for Israel in the international scene in the last while. And I am going to be talking about Eurovision, the Venice Biennale, and J.M. Kutzer. So that is what's coming up just after the break. Do stay tuned, and we will chat to you after that.
Chai FM, your station of choice since 2008.
You're listening to 101.9 Chai FM. This is Studio 972, your favorite Jewish culture and current affairs show. So let's talk about culture, because that is what we're going to be talking about to start off with, and some wins and losses on the Israeli side. So let's start on the positive, and then I'm going to rant a bit on the negative, because I'm annoyed about the negative, but let's talk about the positive. So two positives. First of all, Eurovision, everyone's favorite thing that no one really watches here, but makes a big difference culturally. And Eurovision, after Israel did particularly well in last year's Eurovision, there were some complaints about countries. Of course, there was Israelis that went last year. It was in Austria. There were death threats and protests and all sorts of issues, and Eurovision had to really respond to that. And now we have this situation where basically after this, first of all, the countries were annoyed that the Israelis were organized and actually managed to get the audience vote in. And it's interesting, because if you looked at last year's Eurovision, you'll see that that on the juries, like the professionals that actually vote on this stuff, Israel did quite badly. But on the popular choice, Israel was one of the top countries in the world, and this seemed to have annoyed a number of countries. And so some countries have actually now basically refused to actually attend Eurovision this year. Ireland is one of them. Spain is another. Slovenia is actually saying that they are going to play Palestinian documentaries during this period. A lot of people, when it comes to Eurovision, have this thing, well, like, why is Israel in Eurovision? It's not in Europe. But, you know, neither is Australia. And Australia is also in Eurovision. And it has to do with actually who has the license to show, who's actually, like, subscribed as a national subscriber to the Euro channels. Nothing continental per se about it. But it shows you that Eurovision has stood firm. The Germans said that they would not be pulling out. And that made a big difference in these discussions. And so Israel's going ahead. I believe, I'm not the maven on these things, but I believe that they are going to the semifinals, and they've already gone, and there'll be lots of security, but they're going. And that's how you have to do these things. It has to be under pressure, and you have to, like, stand out there and stand proud. And I think that that is very important. And so the cultural institutions there in Europe are holding for the issue of free expression and free engagement. So that's a good one. Another good one has been the Venice Biennale. So, as you know, there was this big issue in South Africa where there was an artist who had put together an artwork that was basically pro-Gazan, and our government under the Ministry of Culture got a bit annoyed about that, and they pulled it. And so South Africa is not really at that pavilion this year. And instead, they're putting the Biennale on. They're putting this person, the artist rather, is putting it on a private venue nearby where it seems to have gotten some attention. But it's affected the rest of the Biennale quite severely. And the jury took this very sneaky decision there where they said, oh, we're just not going to allow countries. No, we don't want to target Israel. Like, we're not targeting Israel. We're just targeting countries where there's an ICC indictment. In other words, Russia and Benjamin Netanyahu. And so we're just going to not allow those countries to be part of that. And there was an immediate response from the actual Biennale itself. And they took this lying down in no uncertain terms and said that this was not acceptable. They fired the jury and kept Israel in. So, again, we see that the creative sectors are pushing back and actually creating a situation in which this sort of behavior is deemed to be unacceptable. And really, you know, these creative types who are doing this often just get on a bandwagon. They think there's money to be made, and you've got to kind of stand firm and show that this kind of thing is not acceptable. I can remember this happened a few years ago with the Durban Film Festival. They initially, it's an interesting thing, like, they'd never allowed Israeli films before. There was one Israeli film that came, a very minor one about, it really had nothing to do with politics. I think it had to do with a child who was going through some mental health issues or something. That was it. And as a result, they basically stopped. They issued a fourth statement, said, oh, well, we'll no longer have any Israeli films. And that just triggered an enormous amount of engagement from their supporters and stakeholders. Not to say we're going to pull out. Not just like, just like, okay, let's have a discussion about this. You can't, if you want to have, say, films from Europe, then how are you going to ban films from Israel? If you're going to ban films from Israel, are you going to really ban Russian or Iranian ones? Like, what is the point here? And so that was the discussion. Eventually, they basically caved, and they said, all right, well, we'll have Israeli films again, and they had one. And I don't think they've had one since, and a lot of their stuff is pretty anti-Israel, but they don't ban things. And I think that has to be the thing, right? People can choose culture wherever they want to choose it, but once you start with bannings, then that is a violation not just of an Israel position, but it's a violation of a general position about artistic freedom. And this is something which these people don't seem to understand. But so far, at least, it seems to be holding despite the sort of anti-Semitism that has been going on. So that is one element of the debate. Now, let's talk about one which went the other way and which I'm kind of annoyed about. And so get ready for some annoyance, just because, you know, you're never going to hear someone like me on this radio station in particular coming out for the favor of boycott of Israeli culture. But at the same time, cultural festivals and organizations, whatever, actually need to be responsible about the way that they handle their stuff so that unnecessary problems like the one that I'm about to describe don't actually arise. And in this case, we basically had a piece of malpractice, quite frankly, cultural malpractice coming out of the Jerusalem Writers' Festival. You may have seen recently that J.M. Coetzee, who is, of course, a famous South African author, he's been nominated for the Booker Prize, he's got the Nobel Prize. He wrote something called The Life and Times of Michael Kay, which was, I'm told, a reasonable play, although it was an oppressively awful book. Children in our schools have his work Disgrace shoved down their throats during English lectures. So he is quite kind of well regarded. And the Jerusalem Writers' Festival invited him to come and talk at their festival, which is fine, like whatever, you invite whoever you want to invite. But there's a couple things here. First of all, about 10 years ago, they did the same thing. The same festival invited him, and he issued a statement saying, look, he's not going to come to Israel until there's peace, number one, and then went immediately to the Palestinian Writers' Festival, which is sort of next door in Ramallah, and there he said that the... He doesn't like to use words like apartheid. He doesn't even believe that there is a genocide in Turkey, right, with the Armenians. And he has also since then been involved in a number of other campaigns that are to do with Israel. In other words, this guy has a 10-year pedigree of anti-Israel activity, including actual boycotts. And so what are you doing? This, by the way, is not like rocket science. It took me 10 minutes... 5 minutes of Googling to figure out exactly what J.M. Coetzee's position is on this. So, and it's the same festival. So now they invited him again this year. And predictably now his response was even stronger. Having not been able to say that there's a genocide in Armenia with the Turks, he's now very clear that there is one going on in Gaza, and that's why he's not coming. So this festival went, invited this person who has a long pedigree of anti-Israel thing and has, obviously being South African, got strong views on this kind of stuff, and then is surprised when he rejects it with venom. Like, what are you doing? This is not, if you are a proper responsible member of a cultural festival, you don't do something stupid like this. Then on top of that, what do? They actually publicize this. So then they say, they publish the letter that they responded to him with, and he responded to them. And of course, all of the anti-Israel groups, the anti-Israel media, Daily Maverick, all of these people jumped on board and got very excited because, oh, look, you know, J.M. Coetzee, who's the great doyen of I don't know what, and his word really matters. And now he's not coming to this festival. In other words, you've made a mistake. You were an idiot. You invited someone who was supposed to not be there and then were surprised when they responded. And then you make your failure public and then affect Jewish and Israeli writers from around the world. And it's worse than that, right? It's worse than that because not only are there, as has this festival made Jewish voices and Israeli voices more vulnerable, they've also made South African voices more vulnerable, right? If you wanted to invite a South African author to the Jerusalem Festival, there are a dozen, two dozen, three dozen amazing writers from all sorts of backgrounds in this country that would be a great, fresh addition to a festival like that. But instead, you went with an old white guy who has a long anti-Israel pedigree and does not live even in South Africa anymore. He lives in Australia, and that's where he does his work from that he hasn't done for a very long time. And so you are kind of marginalizing South African voices at the expense of what? Because he got a Nobel Prize like 40 years ago. It's absurd. And honestly, the people who are engaged in the Jerusalem Writers' Festival should actually understand that the way that you do this is to do it properly and to not create things where they don't exist. So there we go. That is my cultural roundup. After the break, we're going to be talking about elections.
Chai FM, your station of choice since 2008.
Studio 972 on 101.9 Chai FM. And before we get into the next segment, we are always, of course, happy to have your viewpoints and your takes. 061 895 1019 is the WhatsApp line. And I'm happy, therefore, to get a message from the following person who I was out and about over the long weekend. It was beautiful weather. I went with my family out somewhere to have a bit of food. And there's somebody sitting at one of the tables says, "Oh, that's Benji." And I said, "Yes, hello." And it turns out it was nothing less than Carol Zimmerman, who, of course, is a regular, not only listener, but also a messenger of Chai FM. And I don't think we've ever met before, but she recognized me. I've got a face for radio, as you all know. And she was there, and she we chatted, and she said that she is really enjoying some of the changes that have been made at Chai FM and the commitment to excellence at the station. So, Carol, thank you for reaching out, both on the line and in person. It was very nice to meet you. And I must say, I often run into people in the community who have heard us on Chai FM, even around the world. And it's always gratifying to be able to engage people in that way. Now, let's talk about some elections, because elections matter. By the way, there's this horrendous clip going around on Twitter, and I really would like to see the full thing, because they sort of just cut the and you know, it's sometimes hard from a 1 minute clip, but it's all about I think it's one of the I think it's a writer for the Daily Maverick and someone from the ENCA, and they're talking about how it's irrational to vote and how your vote doesn't make a difference, which is, I think, the worst possible message that anyone could have in a time and place such as this. And for respected journalists to be pontificating in this way is disgraceful, especially since, if you look how close a number of elections in this country have been, I personally have been in situations where literally one vote has made the difference between a really good outcome and a really bad outcome. So those people, I really hope that in the rest of that segment, they actually sort of dialed that nonsense back again, because it was an appalling piece of rubbish. Anyway, that's neither here nor there. There are some big elections coming up. So get ready for a rocky 6 months in particular, but a potentially a rocky one next week. So let's talk about the one that's coming up next week, and we're going to talk about the big three that you're going to be encountering October, November this year. This week is the local government elections of the United Kingdom, right? Now, why should you care of the local government elections? Well, I think it's going to tell us a little bit about where the politics of the UK is going. We obviously on the station have covered in depth the attacks that have been happening on Jews in that country, the stabbings, the burning of ambulances, the shootings at shuls, etc. And, you know, local authorities have some powers about how that works. And what we're seeing is that traditionally in the UK, you had a kind of two-party system. They work in what's called a first-past-the-post system, which means that in a particular area, everyone votes, and if you get 51% and everyone gets 49%, well, unlucky for 49% people, 51 is the one who gets through. And that tends to mean that for a long time there's been a dynamic where you have two major parties, the Labour Party and the Conservative Party. Conservative Party is one of the oldest political formations in the world. And they are, and it kind of swings between the two, one and the other, etc. So that's been the dynamic. But this election is going to be different. And it's going to be different because you've got new entrants from the centre, or not so new, but current entrants from the centre, and new entrants from the right and the left. On the right, you have Nigel Farage's Reform Party, who is a kind of anti-immigrant party, quite aggressive on culture war issues, feels that Britain needs to be for British people, etc. And they are likely to be, if polling is to be believed, to be one of the big winners in this particular election. So that's going to be interesting to see if they do that. And on the other side is the Greens. The Greens are supposedly an environmental party, headed by a very unpleasant Jewish guy called Zach Polanski. And he has been campaigning on Gaza and on another thing, a bunch of other things as well. And there's suggestions that he might take a lot of seats as well. And then in between that, there is the Lib Dems, who look like they might increase marginally around the margins. And then you've got local councils in Wales and Scotland, the Scottish National Party, the Welsh National Party's Plaid Cymru, etc. We're not sure exactly how these are going to do, but particularly Reform is likely to take seats away from the Conservatives, where they potentially may lose as many as 1,000 councillors, and Labour potentially may lose as many as 2,000, according to some polls, and that is quite a big deal, and one that is sort of making a lot of headlines. What's interesting about the Greens is how they are promoting their agenda. So they're going to very left-leaning neighborhoods, and there in the left-leaning neighborhoods, they're pushing in on obviously Gaza is a big issue for them, and LGBT trans rights and lots of extra, you know, economic populism, and they push that in those districts. And then in the Muslim districts, they cut all of that out and they focus almost entirely on Gaza. So they don't talk about any of their LGBTI stuff and whatever. And it's all done in languages that are not English. And their pamphlets kind of focus in on that. And so they play to two different audiences to get the vote of a kind of the left wingers and then the vote of the kind of Islamic section of the of the polity, and that's how they've been able to grow their vote. And what it would mean is that the national parties, the traditional, more national established parties, Labour in particular, and the Conservatives are likely to get squeezed in this election, and that the map that comes out of these councils is going to be, whereas it would have just been in the past, some Labour and some Conservative, is going to be a much more poly map than we currently have. And will likely affect the governance of particular councils. And this could make a big difference in certain places because, if you have a very sort of left-wing council, they may be less keen to enforce proper bylaws and things that are keeping Jews safe. And so that is something of a real risk and something which we'll have to watch. And if it goes very badly, then Keir Starmer, who is the Prime Minister of England, who's already has had a very tough tenure and doesn't seem to have managed to really hit the ground running particularly well in Britain, is likely to come under more pressure, and we don't really know what that will look like going forward. So that is on Britain, and that will already be next week for you to look out for. Now, 6 months from now, we're going to have a really big election time. So get in. So the first one is going to be in October. We're not exactly knowing October, but I'm guessing we're going to have to see when are the Jewish holidays and all of this this year. But there's going to be an Israeli election sometime in October. And we saw, I've already started seeing moves, although the election hasn't actually been announced. We are going to be seeing moves. Already seeing moves rather as the blocks start to stack up. So we saw Naftali Bennett connecting with Yair Lapid, a bit of a shaky start, but he's created a bit of a block, and then he is competing on the sort of anti-Bibi block, which is effectively what it is. There is Lieberman, there's Gadi Eisenkot, there's a couple of others who are also, and there's a question about what's going to happen on the sort of center-right, left block in terms of what's going on. But those moves have already started. It's unusual for an Israeli election to actually be so long. You know, normally Israeli coalition governments in Israel don't last their full terms. But now they're going to be. And this is going to make a big difference, right? Naftali Bennett accuses the current coalition of being anti-Zionist because of the Haredi parties who won't serve in the army and some of the things that have happened there. And there's been a lot of consternation between the sort of diaspora community leadership and the Netanyahu government. You've got the Americans involved, etc. So, and of course, you have October 7th and Bibi's handling of the war. Now, it's not automatic that just because you have a bad war, or if you have any war, that something happens. You know, Golda Meir won the first war after the Yom Kippur War, for example. It took until 1977 before she was gotten rid of by the currently could. So it really just depends on, and what a lot of pundits are saying, about where the war is seen at the time of the vote when the elections come in October. So if there is still Iran sticking around, causing chaos, firing missiles, whatever, people might judge the whole few years that we've been through here as being a major disaster, and therefore may punish Bibi and put other people in place. But, you know, if suddenly the Iranian regime falls in the next 2 months and is seen as a disaster, well, then he can say, look, you know, we may have messed up on October 7th, but now the main sponsor of terror in the region is gone, and I'm to be thanked for that, so you should thank me. And that's really, I think, so far at least, what the main thing about the election campaign will be. But it's also, of course, brought into sharp relief the other issues that are going on in Israeli society around people serving and not serving, around money for different things, and so this is, you know, every single time you start talking about Israeli elections, people always say, listen, this is the most consequential Israeli election in history. And it always is until the next one. So this is going to be a very consequential one. If for no other reason that, Bibi is on the ballot for another time. So, that is what is going to be going on there in October, and expect that it's going to be quite a rough fought election. And then moving closer to home, we've had our election that has now been announced. You've already heard me speak a little bit about this over the last few weeks about these elections and what they might actually mean. And ours are going to, it's now been officially announced for the 4th of November, so that's 6 months' time. Helen Ziller is... Ugogo, as they're now calling her, is ziplining over potholes and rowing down streets and breaking into the metro building to uncover corruption and records and all sorts of things, and this is a huge issue, and really the local government elections is going to be fought very strongly around Johannesburg, and a lot of the parties seem to be putting forward candidates to the extent that it's going to be almost like a national election inside Joburg because of the personality. So Herman Mashaba is running, Helen Ziller is running, Kenny Kuneni from the PA seems to be running. They're talking about Bongani Buloy from MK running in from their place. So these are all like big ticket names that are going to be throwing their hats in the ring, and really, I think, trying to ginny up support. The one group who we don't know really has an election yet is, or the candidate yet is, the ANC. They're saying they're only going to pick it in June. Now, traditionally, these things are picked by the regions of the ANC. So the people in Joburg, the ANC people in Joburg will say, look, we really want person X to lead, and so we're going to lead. But that hasn't happened. And so now the ANC is also saying, well, we're not sure that there's anyone who really can lead in the Joburg region. There's someone called Musuku Loiso, I think her name is. I think so. Is the deputy, and they were kind of saying, well, that should be the main mayor. And they haven't been able to do that. And no one really knows who they are. The current mayor is Dada Morero. I think he started off his term saying that nobody should expect big things and changes from him. And he has, in fact, lived up to that promise. So that, you know, he has actually done a promise that he has kept. And so the ANC is actually talking about bringing in someone from the outside. You know, I don't know. Who knows exactly. But someone with brand name recognition, which would not go down well, actually, with the local ANC, because it stands on their turf and takes away tenders and all sorts of things. So the ANC is in a bit of a quagmire at the moment and hasn't really gotten going. But the ANC tends to be like an elephant in that, you know, once it makes up its mind, it can get going. But it's having serious internal problems, and they certainly don't have anyone so far that we've seen that will really but able to get going in this regard, and that seems to be somewhat of an issue when it comes to this for the ANC. So we will have to see. The other problem that they're having, of course, is that the South African Communist Party is saying that they're not going to run with the ANC. They're going to run their own independent candidates. I don't understand the strategy from the SACP. All the polling says that like 1% of the party could possibly get a councillor. So I don't know. This could be like one or two councillors in different places across the country. I'm not sure what that's going to do for anybody. I suspect that the real threat from the SACP is to say, look, we're not going to support your ground, your get out the vote strategy, because the SACP does have a lot of activists and they're all quite engaged, shall we say, and knock on doors and schlep people out of rooms and whatnot to go and vote. And so I think that the threat here might be, guys, look, we're not going to provide our infrastructure to help you, and that's going to affect your vote. And I think that they're trying to get the ANC, and there's lots of very acrimonious discussions going on. Kasatu, Bladen Zamande, Solly Mpayile, all of these guys who are not very happy and are threatening to run their own shows going forward. And that's quite a good thing. I think that the SACP has a bad influence on the ANC. It makes it behave in ways that perhaps it should not. And so, if they disappeared, I don't think anyone would cry too much. But they're also going to be running in the election. So it'll be interesting to see if they actually put up a half-decent candidate for Joburg as well. And then, of course, we have the American midterms, right? Now, midterms are like, they're not voting for the president. You vote for, that's basically the Congress and a third of the Senate, if I'm not mistaken. And here there's some potential issues. Trump is having a bit of a rough time on the Iranian war. Not really because people are coming home in body bags, which is normally what Americans don't like, but more that, you know, it's driving up petrol prices, and that's a pocketbook issue, and that's something that Americans tend to vote on. So it's going to be interesting to see if Trump can actually get that down in the next while. If he can't, he'll almost certainly lose control of Congress, which is important, especially because of some of this gerrymandering stuff which is going on, which I'm not going to go into. But if he does really badly, he could actually lose in the Senate. And the Democrats have some seriously problematic people who are running. So there's a guy with an SS tattoo, a Democrat, who's running against Susan Collins, who is a sort of moderate Republican in the state of Maine. In the state of Michigan, the front runner or close front runner at the moment is someone called Al Sayed, who's a big fan of Hezbollah, and they're running in Michigan. And so if you have a big wave where people who are annoyed with Trump because of Iran or because of some other stuff decide to not vote for their local person to punish Trump, you could actually have a situation in which both the Congress and the Senate are in control of the Democrats, and then, you know, Trump can get impeached and what's called convicted and thrown out of office, and that could really push the U.S. into a great deal of turmoil. So the midterms are going to be a big one to watch. There's a bunch of other things going on in Florida where some of the pro-Israel Democrats are going to have some issues with some of the Republican pro-Israel Republicans. There's stuff in Texas going on. There's a new law which has just been passed, which doesn't allow districts to be drawn according to race. So there's a lot going on in the American scene, and we can discuss more of it as we go for the next 6 months. But that's going to be on the 5th of November. Our election is the 4th of November. Then the October is the Israelis, and the next week is the English. So get ready for some electionitis. I'm Benji Shulman. This is 101.9 Chai FM.
Chai FM, 101.9 megahertz of life.
101.9 Chai FM. I'm Benji Shulman, and this is Studio 972, your favorite Jewish cultural and current affairs show. Now, we were talking just before the break about the American elections and what's potentially might happen there, etc., and how that could affect things, whatever. One of the elements which is very interesting and something where there's likely to be a change, both from the Israeli and the American side, and one which is an interesting structural change, which tells us quite a lot about the society, is the renegotiation of the aid to Israel from America in the form of weaponry. Okay. And what has happened, if I'm not mistaken, I mean, I'm happy to be corrected in this 061-895-1019. I think it stems from the period of the 73 war with Egypt. And after the peace there, a sort of thing was signed that said that the Americans would keep the quantitative edge that Israel had always had, or Israel had needed to keep the Egyptians at bay. And this basically meant provision of weapons. Now, in effect, what that has ended up being is a kind of a subsidy of arms for the Israeli defense forces, right? And it's not really that that the Americans give money to the Israelis. What they do is they give money to their local defense industry, to the American defense industry, who then sells those or gives those weapons to Israel, and that's like Iron Dome stuff and for the F-35s, which are part of a big program, and even just the sort of some of the basic guns that are used in the Israeli combat units. And that comes to about $4.3 billion, excuse me, I think a year, if I'm not mistaken, or that might be the total. I can check for you. But in any case, that is the amount of money which goes to Israel. It's via the American system. So it's basically a giant boondoggle for the American arms industry, and then they use that to give an ally. Now, what people like to say is that this is that Israel is therefore the biggest supplier of, or I guess is the biggest supplier of aid from America, which is true, but it's also not true, because first of all, a lot of other countries get actual aid in the form of food subsidies and actual money and whatever other else, technical assistance from the Americans, which is very large. Israel doesn't get that. It's just weapons that they use to defend themselves, number one. And number two, it's cheaper than American deployments in other parts of the world. So, for example, South Korea, where you have American army being parked there all the time, that costs an enormous amount of American deployments, American troops on the ground to keep the North Koreans in line. Israel doesn't ask for that. It just asks for weapons, and it defends itself and actually America as well by striking American enemies in Lebanon and in Iran and whatever. But this military subvention has become more and more an issue in the public discourse in America, and given the war with Gaza, has become less and less popular from different people. Now, the Israelis have actually said that they are quite happy to just do away with this. But then, of course, the American arms guys were like, no, please don't, because, you know, we still want the subvention. But nonetheless, the kind of contract which was signed, I think, with Obama initially in the 2000s, mid-2000s, I think it's a 10-year thing, so it's 2016 probably, is now lapsing, and now they're going to renegotiate it. And what looks like is going to happen is they aren't going to be doing this sort of subsidy anymore. Israel's going to have to buy the weapons, but at the same time, they're going to work with Israel to actually do joint ventures, because the Americans get something else out of this, which is the great research IP and battle-tested machines that the Israelis can actually give them, because they are in a live war zone all the time. And so the Americans don't want to miss out on this either. And so this is the way that the thing is being structured, so that it no longer is a domestic issue with America. But they can still, you know, do work with Israel. And so, like, for one example, an Israeli 3D printing firm has joined the Pentagon manufacturing program. So Stratasys, which is an Israeli company, is going to qualify and scale 3D printed parts for the Pentagon as it works to modernize supply chains and aging defense platforms. And so this organization, this company, has actually been put into a program of other companies in America known as the Joint Additive Manufacturing Acceptability for Pilot Parks Program, or the JAMA. I don't know what they call it, so the JAMA. And it's a multi-million dollar investment expanding the military's ability to deploy manufactured parts at scale, basically 3D printed parts for weapons and planes and naval systems and all sorts of things. And this Israeli company is actually going to be part of that. And this is an example, I think, of how things are going to start moving, whereas you're not going to get – Israel will pay for the weapons, but they'll also be doing joint ventures, which I think will help bring down the cost and certainly the political cost of doing this. Now, the thing is that you know whatever that $4 billion or $3 billion is going to also be a big push, right, in terms of now the budget in Israel, because that budget is has to going to be found somewhere, and it's going to push up the military spend by 10 to 15%. Now that's not good for Israeli spend a hell of a lot of GDP already on this stuff, and that's a lot for them, and so that is a bit of a problem, but in a way it might be a good thing, because if you think about it, the big case against the Europeans is that America has also gives them not some a subsidy, but basically pays for their military defense by being under the nuclear umbrella and all of this sort of thing. And as a result, the Europeans have not been spending on their militaries, and rather have been putting that into social welfare. And so now they can't defend themselves. Now that hasn't happened in Israel, but there has still been a push on the budget, particularly from the Haredim, who are demanding more and more subsidies. And so that is a form of welfare. And I do wonder if suddenly if the Israelis are having to pay proper money into their budget again for military, then that subsidy that the Haredim are taking might actually have to be renegotiated for the defense of the country. And that will actually assist in balancing the budget, because basically the Israeli economy is under pressure from the kind of yeshivas and welfare payments of the Haredi world, and they would have to trim some of the fat on that budget. So it's going to be interesting to see how that gets negotiated. I'm Benji Shulman, and this is Studio 972. Be back after this.
Chai FM, your station of choice since 2008.
101.9 Chai FM, as we come to the end of the show at about 14, nearly 52 here. So a few minutes before we end. And so just do something light. Talk about Pilgrim's Rest. I don't know if you've ever been to Pilgrim's Rest. I have. It's one of the first mining towns that we had in the country for gold that kind of sprung up, and it still exists. And it kind of experienced a decline after Barberton was found, and of course Johannesburg. But they still kind of have some stuff there that you can go and have a look at and see. And I've even gone there and panned for gold. So you take like soil or things, and you put like a water, and like literally how they used to do gold mining back in the old days before the deep mining of Johannesburg, a lot of mining was done alluvially. So you actually would like take soil and swig it around in a sill, and you pick out the bits of gold from that. And I've done that. It's quite a lot of fun. And some big stuff has been found there over the years, from different, including a six kilogram thing called Breda, which was a 6 kilogram nugget of gold. And now it looks like Pilgrim's Rest might be on the way to making a comeback, because Teta Gold Mines has announced plans to do a process underground mining ore. And they're going to do this by purchasing a ball mill circuit that manufactures modular mining plant equipment, and is going to be produced in South Africa and have high-performance ball mills and installed in containers and integrated feed systems. And this, they hope, said the new gold mine plant would extract material from several historic sites, including current mine sites such as Beta, Frankfurt, and the Rietfontein mines. And I suppose that by bringing in new equipment and trying to figure out what was going on, they might actually be able to extract mines, like I guess they did here in Johannesburg a few years ago when they started re-mining the old mine dumps that used to operate here. So maybe you'll be able to go to Pilgrim's Rest sometime and actually see how that has worked out for them. So it's a very, very interesting thing. By the way, you know, you can actually still visit old gold mines in Johannesburg. There's a few parks where you can see the original mining stamps that actually used to crush the gold. And of course, in the Standard Bank Gallery, it's the Standard Bank building in town is actually on top of an old mining shaft that you can go visit. And of course, Golders City. So that whole mining heritage still really exists in South Africa and is something we don't pay enough attention to. But we do bring us to the end of the show for today. So thank you, everyone, for joining us. To Craig, who pushes all the big red buttons. Vusi's on the sound. Dylan Berger, who's always doing something. And to you, dear listener, who joins us every single week. Do join us next week on Studio 972.